Hello, and welcome to the podcast portion of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, previews, reviews, and interviews with baseball authors, artists, filmmakers, musicians, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan, if it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Tim Kirchin was one of the first interviews I did for the bookshelf in its current iteration. Over the years, I found him very approachable in his work. He doesn't take himself too seriously, which I think is a reason people in the game find him so easy to deal with. We spoke recently about how baseball and his job have changed in the intervening years since his previous treatise, Is This a Great Game or What?
Tim Kirchin, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
So what is it exactly about sacrifice flies that fascinates you so much?
Well, there's actually a lot there if you really look closely enough. You can get a sacrifice fly while hitting into a double play. You can get a sacrifice fly while reaching base. You can hit an infield fly rule caught by an infielder on the infield and still somehow end up with a sacrifice fly. Also, the first year that we continuously kept the statistics, starting 1954, that year Gil Hodges had 19 sacrifice flies, and that remains the record today in a single season. And in this book, there's about 20 other little bits of information that will make you believe that sacrifice flies are much more interesting than you thought they were. And the point of the book is, in part, if I can make you interested in sacrifice flies, hopefully I can really make you interested in some of the other more interesting parts of the game.
Now, sacrifice flies strikes me as a kind of statistic that comes and goes as far as its important usage. I mean, I don't know how long ago it was we stopped counting game-winning RBIs. So things come and go into the lore and legends of baseball numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And with sacrifice flies, they really don't make any sense when you look at someone like Bob Boone, who played for years as a pretty ordinary hitter, and he's got as many sacrifice flies as some of the great power hitters of all time. Maybe proving, of course, that once these power hitters get the ball airborne, it doesn't end up a sacrifice fly. It ends up as a home run. And the thought that, you know, Cal Ripken and Eddie Murray are right there at the top of the sacrifice fly list and never led the league in sacrifice flies in any season is kind of interesting also. All sorts of things about sacrifice flies, and you're right. Sometimes they're in vogue, sometimes you see a lot, and sometimes they just disappear. It's really interesting how it works.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting is an older fan who doesn't follow the game as much now as he did when he was a kid. There are a lot of names in the book that I found unfamiliar, and I imagine it might be the same for a lot of your readers, except for fans of those teams that the players are on. Was this a conscious decision? Does this give a voice like the everyday grinder out there?
Yeah, Ron, part of my issues with baseball today is we don't have that many characters or that many really well-spoken guys, in part because they're afraid to speak up because of social media. So they think it doesn't do any good to be funny or be a character because it's going to come back and get you somehow on the internet or on Twitter somehow. What I did was I found the funniest, cleverest, smartest players that I could find. And for all the stories I did for this book, I went to some of those guys and said, help me with this. My thinking always has been, I want something interesting. I want something funny. I want something insightful. I don't need to get it from the star player if he can't provide it. I want to get it from somebody who plays the game. And then I think it gives a little more depth to the game that the backup infielder for the Indians really knows the game, even though he doesn't play it as well as, say, the star center fielder for the Mariners or whatever it is.
Now, you bring up an interesting point that I was going to say for later, but since you did bring it up, we're about the same age, and you've been doing this for a long time. How have you adjusted to the social media aspects of the job?
Not particularly well, I must say, Ron. This is a difficult thing for me. I don't believe you should be breaking stories in 140 characters on Twitter. I was taught a different way to do this, and yet people are really good at doing it now. I haven't quite gotten there yet. I've had to adjust in a lot of ways because everybody wants everything right now, and there's really no time to sit back and examine something. We need your opinion, and we need it now, and we need it in 140 characters on Twitter, and I'm pretty uncomfortable doing that most of the time. I struggle with the whole Twitter situation. I'm doing better than I used to, but it's difficult. And the fact that so many people out there are now so hooked into so many sites on the internet that give you very good information, I've had to work even harder to come up with something, whether it's an interesting stat or an interesting quote or something from a player. I've had to work much harder just to get something on my own because I find that so many other people out there, just average fans, can look on the internet and find some really interesting stuff. My challenge is always to find something that they don't know, and it gets harder and harder every day.
The competition must be fierce. Is ESPN, have things changed there markedly since the MLB Network has come on board?
Yeah, absolutely. We have competition now, and great. We love it. Competition is good. I think we've gotten better. I think we've tried harder. Not that we didn't try hard before, not that we weren't good before, but I think we're better now. I think everybody's better by competition. So to me, the more the merrier, the more people that are involved and invested in baseball, whether it's through fantasy baseball or on another network, it's all the better. The more conversation, the more data we get about baseball, the better for all of us. That's how I've always looked at this.
One of the things that I found in reading the book is the chapters remind me of, is it like going to a restaurant where you enjoy everything on the menu? It's hard for me to pick out a favorite chapter in your book. I think if I had to pick, I'd pick the chapter on box scores.
Well, that's my favorite chapter too, Rod. I'm so glad. Mainly because it's been such an important part of my life, because ever since I can remember, and I mean age 4, I was looking at the box scores, and my dad, being a mathematician with a great feel for the game and a really good player in his own day, he taught me what those box scores were about and what they meant and what is inside of them. And I have been absolutely fascinated by them for my entire life. So for 20 years, I cut out every box score, and I did this as an adult. Every box score of every game for 20 years, pasted them in these little notebooks, big notebooks of mine, and I would carry them around with me wherever I went during the course of a baseball season. And I never missed a day. 20 years, never missed a day, just like Cal Ripken, although I don't think he missed a day in 20 years either. But the beauty of it is I always felt like if I had the box scores on my hip and by my side, it was just like a trusty friend there. I could look through there and get a lot of the information that I needed.
And now, of course, you don't need to do that because everything's available online.
Right, and everything was available online back then also, Ron. I just felt like when I did it with my own two hands, I felt better about it. I still keep a day-by-day book, which I've done every day for 26 years and never missed a day, where I write down every single day who played, who won, who's the winning pitcher, what the standings look like. I keep about 100 different starting pitchers just to try to keep up with the game on a daily basis, because I feel like when I write it down better, I see it better, I absorb it better, I remember it better. And so I still do a lot of stuff by hand, and I still use the internet at the same time. It's a good combination. It works. At least it works for me.
Another one of the chapters I enjoyed is titled "The Quirk Gins." What is?
Yeah.
It sounds like an award. So, what is a quirk gin?
Well, a quirk gin is just something that I came up with. I've been doing this my whole life, also looking in box scores, looking at games, and trying to find the funny, interesting, crazy things that happen during the course of a major league game that is worthy of noting. It's more, these quirk gins happen way more in baseball than they do in the other sports. Just for instance, Scott Sizemore, who's an infielder, second baseman, third baseman, he played first base for the first time in his whole career. And the third inning of his first game ever as a first baseman, he took part in a triple play. And I looked it up at Steve Garvey, Mark Grace, Rafael Palmeiro, and Fred McGriff played 8,599 games at first base combined and never took part in a triple play. And Scott Sizemore took part in a triple play in his third career inning at first base. That is a cork gin. And it's just these strange, odd things that happen. Some are just galactically stupid, have absolutely no meaning to them. But the fun part is baseball is filled with things like that. So when Bartolo Colon hits a home run at age 42 and is the oldest player to hit his first career home run, that's the definition of a cork gin.
One of the things on my bucket list is I would love to be a fly on the wall at the Elias Sports Bureau for a day. Because the way they can come up with anything on the spot, and you always hear the broadcast referring to our friends at the Elias Sports Bureau tell us this, that, or the other thing. So, and you mention them quite often too. They're a wonderful reference, and I don't think people are aware of the uber nerds who do this for a living.
Yeah, they are uber nerds, but the one thing, Ron, that's really important to keep in mind, they all have a great feel for the game also, meaning they're not just looking up stuff just for the sake of saying, look at this cool thing we looked up. The stuff they look up, for the most part, has great value and great meaning and great context. If it's a misleading statistic, and they've told me this many times, we're not looking that up for you because that doesn't mean anything. In fact, it's misleading, and that's not what we're here to do. But those people at the Elias, I called Ken Hurt, one of the Hurt brothers and Hurt sons who works at the Elias, and called him my best friend in the whole world in this book because of all the things he's helped me with. And it's just amazing what they can find if they put in the proper query. But the only thing I have going for me is that every once in a while I'll think of something myself and say, what about this? What about that? I do that virtually every day of my life. But the only people that can really find that stuff, the really intricate stuff, is the Elias Sports Bureau. I love those guys. They're the best.
And that's one of the things you do have to know is how to phrase the question properly and know what you're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. The query is the most important thing because there are different dynamics to every question. And as long as you present it properly, you know, I just asked him the other day, Josh Reddick of the A's got 10 hits in 12 at-bats in a three-game series. So I asked, you know, when's the last time an A's player got 10 hits in 12 at-bats in a three-game series? And the answer was Al Simmons in 1925. I mean, that's beautiful when you get an answer like that. And, of course, it's also beautiful Josh Reddick got 10 hits in 12 at-bats and scored one run total in those three games. That's as bizarre as anything.
Well, Bryce Harper had a very interesting line just the other day.
Right. And again, Ron, this is what I live for, as pathetic as my life may seem. He batted 7 times in a game and had no official at-bats. That's never happened in baseball history. And it continued a streak of 12 consecutive at-bat plate appearances without an official at-bat. Of course, no one's ever done that. And he walked 13 times in one series, which the Elias told us in a very short amount of time that no one has ever walked 13 times in any series in the history of Major League Baseball. So that was quite a weekend for Bryce Harper. And, of course, the Cubs won all 4 of those games, which makes the note really even better.
Now, I caught you the other day on an episode of Pardon the Interruption where you thought that the Nationals would win.
Yes, well, yeah, I have to predict a series. Like, I actually know what's going to happen, which obviously I don't, and that's obviously the most important and the most beautiful part of the game is we have no idea. So I was caught back a little bit when they asked me, who's going to win the series? So I think I said, well, I think the Nationals have better pitching, which I still believe. But as it turns out, I was wrong again. But one thing we do, Ron, we never apologize for being wrong about an opinion on baseball, because the game is just too good. It will not allow you to figure it out. It is too unpredictable, and that is its greatest beauty of all.
One of the things I've always felt is that I can't think of any other professions besides being a sports commentator, pundit, whatever you want to call it, or a weather person who can be wrong so often and still keep their job.
Yeah, 1991, Ron, I picked the Angels to win the division. This was the AL West. and I picked the Twins to finish last, which was seventh place. And at the end of the season, the Twins finished first, and the Angels finished last. So I had them completely backwards. And someone wrote me after that when I was at Sports Illustrated and said, you know, you got these completely wrong, don't you? Which, of course, I did. But the point is, that year the Angels finished at 500, and the Twins still won the division. I wasn't picking a team that was horrendous to win. But the point is, this is how predictions work in baseball. And I repeat, I'm not going to apologize for getting them wrong. I'm also never, never going to boast if I ever get anything right. Because if I did, it was mostly luck. That's the beauty of the game.
Well, one of the things, when the season starts out and everything's written down, the phrase is on paper. On paper, if everything goes well and nobody gets hurt, no trades are made, this is what might happen based on the best things we can come up with. But obviously, you know, it doesn't, man plans, God laughs, as they say.
Right. I mean, with injuries especially, they can change everything. And with baseball being, to me at least, the hardest game in the world to play, if you're off by an eyelash, if you're just off by a little bit, you go from a really good player to a very ordinary player just like that. I don't think it happens like this in other sports, but in the ultimate skill sport, baseball, it happens like this all the time. And that's why teams look so good on paper, and then a few things throw them off their rhythm, mess with the chemistry of the team, and suddenly a good team is a bad team, and suddenly a bad team is a good team. Every year, Ron, it happens like this. Some team comes out of nowhere and just wins, and you say, how did that happen? Where did that happen? And sometimes there is no explanation, which, again, is what makes the game so great.
One thing that you often hear from broadcasters is that baseball gives you the chance to see something you've never seen before. As someone who's been on the scene for as long as you have, can you guess how many times over the course of a season you experience something like that?
Oh, I say that all the time, Ron. Something happens where I just slap my forehead and say, I've never seen that before. And it's the smallest of levels, the quirkiest of levels. I saw a foul ball this year hit off the catcher, and it landed in the umpire's breast pocket of his shirt. And it nestled in his pocket. You couldn't place it there any better than that guy just hit it there. And I said to myself, I have never seen that before. I saw an umpire a couple years ago run to the mound to warn a pitcher, you know, let's speed this up or whatever. And he ran around the pitcher's mound in a circle. I've never seen that before. I promise you, 10, 20, 100 times during the course of the season, I'll just say to myself, wow, I'm 59. I covered baseball for 37 years. And I don't think I've ever seen that before. And that's the beauty. How many people go to work every day and there's a chance they're going to see something that they've never seen before? Not many people have that kind of job.
I wonder if that was the A's pitcher who chased, who didn't like it when Alex Rodriguez crossed the mound.
Right. That was Dallas Braden, who I work with now, and he has explained that to me more than once over the years, exactly what happened on that play. It was unique, to say the least.
I want to switch gears a bit and talk about the actual work that went into producing a book like this. It's been almost 10 years since your first book, Is This a Great Game or What, came out. And I was wondering why you waited so long.
Well, I've got some issues at home. I take care of my mom. She's 92. She's got Alzheimer's. And I love her to death. And it takes a lot of time to do the right thing at home. Plus, you know, work is overwhelming most of the time, especially during the baseball season. So it just became a case where I had too many stories just rattling around in my head. And I said to myself, okay, I've got to get these out, and I got to get them out now. So I just sat down at the end of the World Series, literally the day I got home, and said, okay, I'm writing this book. I'm writing it now. And I'm going to finish it the day I go to spring training. And I'm not going into spring training being unfinished, because this has got to be done, because I can't let this affect my regular season job. And even though I worked all during the off season, as you know, writers really need a deadline. Deadlines are our best friend. And when I set my own deadline, I said, all right, this is it. I got to get these stories down. And I got to have these two books where I can look at them and say, all my stories, my favorite stuff is in those two books. That's my career right there.
Well, how do you keep track of all these things over the course of all this time? I mean, do you write stuff down immediately when it happens? Do you have a fantastic memory? What's your process?
Well, I write everything down in my notebooks, which I keep the exact kind of notebook every year. I stack them all up in my closet. They're all over my house. And I make sure everything is written down in there. I also have everything, almost everything written down somewhere in my computer, so I have it backed up somewhere. But honestly, Ron, I hope this doesn't sound too self-serving. I can remember stuff. I can remember great stories. And when I hear a great story, it's hard for me to forget it. Since I collect great stories, when I hear a good one, I tell myself, don't ever forget that one. And a lot of times, I can just bring it back. And I guess that's my greatest strength, if I have any.
Did you find the process change from doing your first book?
Yeah, well, this is my third book, actually. I wrote another book about 20 years ago, but that's another story. I'll tell you about it some other time. But, yes, the process had changed in that the actual, process of putting out a book took longer than it did the last time. The last book I wrote, I finished it essentially the day I went to spring training, and it hit the bookstores in the middle of May. This one I finished at the end of the end of the season in 2015, and it came out a year later. So it just takes longer to do it, which left me a little bit uncomfortable at times, but overall it turned out really well, so I was really, really happy with that.
Is ESPN supportive of its people who want to publish? Is there any sort of vetting process like the CIA has for its employees who want to do a book?
Well, I always have to go to the people at ESPN because we used to have a publishing house right here. And I used to have to go to them first and say, would you publish my book? And if they say no, then I would go to the next step. But that's no longer the case. But I always go to the people in charge and say, just want you to let you know I'm writing a book. I need clearance to do that. I got it. And then once the book came out, people here have been extremely supportive. I got to show my book on virtually every sports center I went on, radio show I went on, and, of course, the show that I do every night, Baseball Tonight. So I'm really, really pleased with the way ESPN handled this, and I'm very appreciative for all they did.
Now, one of the things that struck me was the use, albeit infrequently, of a word we cannot say on this show. If Sacrifice Flies was a movie, that would automatically give it an R rating. Was that a conscious decision?
It was a really difficult decision, and I'm not real comfortable with it. But I talked to my editor about it because there are about five or six really bad words in this book, and only about five or six because that's not my nature and that's not the language I use. But sometimes you have to use that word for the true meaning of the story, and I'm not comfortable that there's going to be a young kid that reads that, and I'm not very happy about that. But when I checked with my editors, they said, Tim, you got to be true to this story. You got to be true to the book, and these words have to go in. And I said, well, I'm not comfortable doing it, but they said, it's okay to do this. It's a grown-up book, and people will understand this is some of the language used in the major league.
Sure.
So as much as it bothered me, I think it was the right thing to do.
So ultimately, what's the takeaway you want readers to get out of Sacrifice Flies?
Well, I just want them to enjoy it. I want them to sit down and smile once in a while about the game. I want them to laugh out loud once in a while. And, of course, I want to teach them. I want to educate them about something that they might not know about because I get to go sometimes to places where the average fan doesn't get to go. I'm just wondering still if we have enough fun watching and being around baseball today. It's supposed to be fun. I'm in sports. I do what I do because what this is, as important as it is, the Toys and Games Department. We're supposed to enjoy this, and I worry that we're not enjoying it enough. So to have a chuckle here and there, I think it's okay. It's more than okay because the game is so hard, so difficult to play, and it's so hard to cover because it's so long and just relentless. And if you don't have a laugh with it here and there, it'll just eat you up. And this is just my way of saying, let's enjoy this game a little bit more.
And we've been talking with Tim Kirkchin, author of the new book, I'm Fascinated by Sacrifice Flies, Inside the Game We All Love, published by St. Martin's Press. Tim, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
And that was our conversation with Tim Kirkjian. Please tune in again next time when we'll have another interesting guest from the world of baseball pop culture. In the meantime, please visit Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on baseball and literature and the rest of the pop culture world. Don't forget, if you have a question, please don't be afraid to drop me a line at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. Thanks, everybody. See you again next time.
So grand, he'd have said, "Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land. Gee, it's a wonder."